Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that, as the holiday season approaches, finds itself thinking more and more about family relations, both the good and the bad. That's at least partly because over the decades, such disparate films as The Magnificent Ambersons, Kramer vs. Kramer, Parenthood, and so many others have explored virtually every facet of what the term family truly means. The same holds true for the two films that we will be discussing this week, the murder mystery Knives Out and the drama A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Let's begin by donning a red sweater and our favorite pair of sneakers, which is what Fred Rogers used to do at the beginning of every episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Even though he stopped doing television in 2001 and he died 2 years later, Rogers, creator and star of the popular children's program, is still a familiar presence. That's partly because of Morgan Neville's 2018 documentary about Rogers, Won't You Be My Neighbor, but it's partly, too, because there was something both endearingly simple about Rogers' delivery, which spoke mainly to children, and temptingly satiric, which provided comedians such as Eddie Murphy with a wealth of material. Director Marielle Heller, working from a script by Micah Fitzerman Blue and Noah Harpeter, gives us a film that appreciates both sides of Rogers' appeal. Based on a 1998 Esquire magazine article written by Tom Juneau, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood focuses on a writer named Lloyd Vogel, played by Matthew Reese, also an Esquire magazine writer, who blanches when told he has to write a short profile of Rogers for a spread about heroes. Vogel doesn't trust easily, and he has a history of family dysfunction that caused it. And his acceptance of Rogers doesn't come easily, but come it does, ever so gradually. And the process, even given the obvious dramatic inventions, feels authentic, thanks to Heller's deft directorial touch and to the casting of Hollywood's nicest man, Tom Hanks, as Fred Rogers himself. Hanks doesn't impersonate Rogers so much as channel him, and the result is both unnerving and inspiring at once.
Right, and I don't think that Tom Hanks exactly disappears into the role of Mr. Rogers.
No.
To the extent that we are always aware we are watching Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers, but I almost feel like that's by design. I was worried about that going into this movie, wondering, can Tom Hanks convincingly disappear into a role? But I don't think he necessarily needs to. You're right. He does kind of approximate the way that Mr. Rogers talked, which was a very unusual speaking manner, because he kind of had this Pennsylvania drawl, and there were always pauses between each word as if he was really thinking about what the next word was going to be. And Tom Hanks nails that cadence really, really well. But I think that his casting in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood kind of underlines what Heller is doing here, because this whole movie is sort of a meta exercise in a way. I mean, it's constantly breaking the fourth wall, because the whole movie is framed as an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So it begins with Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers looking directly into the camera at us in the audience and walking us through the story, and it keeps cutting back to the set. Every time there's like a transitional sequence where somebody's going on the subway or getting on a plane, it's shot in the same way that the transitional sequences on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood were shot. There are these fantasy moments where Lloyd himself is kind of trapped in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I didn't much care for those.
No, I didn't either.
And so I think the whole thing kind of works. And I want to credit Marielle Heller, whose last movie was also about a curmudgeonly writer, Can You Ever Forgive Me? And that was a movie about a person who you knew would never change. And that was sort of the thrill of that movie in a way, whereas this is a film that's about a man that we know is going to change. And that's because he's been exposed to the effervescent niceness of Mr. Rogers. Although I'd love to see a movie that pits Mr. Rogers against that film's protagonist, Lee Israel. I wonder if he would even be able to make a dent in that woman. But I think the thing does work, even though it keeps threatening to slip into some really cloying, overly precious stuff. I mean, this is Mr. Rogers we're dealing with, so you kind of always have to walk that fine line. But I think it works. And much has been made of the fact that Tom Hanks is not the main character of this movie, despite being top billed. Mr. Rogers is really a supporting role in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which I think is both good and bad, because the Matthew Reese character is our protagonist. And I wasn't exactly hooked by his character or by his arc, just because, as you said in your intro, Dan, it seems so predestined. And the parallels between his fractured relationship with his father are really, really obvious when compared to his kind of burgeoning relationship with Mr. Rogers. But I think that having Tom Hanks in such a small role makes his presence as Mr. Rogers all that more powerful, because we're not spending all of this time with him. He's kind of flitting about on the edges and then comes in and makes a point and disappears again for a while. And I actually thought that was the right choice. I think it makes Mr. Rogers more of a presence in a way, rather than having him be in every scene of the film.
Well, as you know, I'm not a Mr. Rogers aficionado because my familiarity honestly came from the documentary that we saw 9 months ago.
Won't You Be My Neighbor?
And from Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood on Saturday Night Live. So that's not really a good intro. But I would like to explore that, the notion of the conceit that they use here, focusing on the writer, just a little bit more, because this person is a real person. So I think if it had been a fictional person, it probably would not have worked as well. But the piece that he wrote is readily available online, and it's very intriguing to go back and sort of look at, you know, it.
It's an unusual piece because it's not a standard character profile that you would expect from Esquire. It's sort of this free-floating, almost free-form stream of consciousness kind of piece about memory and trauma and childhood.
Right.
And Mr. Rogers, like in this movie, keeps coming in at opportune times, and then it goes on to something else. So I think it captures the flow of that piece in an interesting way.
Right. And so I think – so once you have this sort of conceit or this framing device focused on a real person, I was okay with the fact that, like you said, you know that his character is going to have this epiphanous, you know, experience or whatever. If it had been fake, it probably would have felt fake.
Although I don't know how much of the character arc here is real. I haven't looked into it. I do know that Tom Juneau, who wrote the original piece, did say that his worldview was changed by the time that he spent with Mr. Rogers. I don't know if he really had a wife and newborn son at home
and if
he was estranged from his father.
No.
All of that stuff feels kind of obvious, even if it's acted really well by all of the players.
And it is acted really
well by
everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I think what worked for me, and there are many things about this movie, most everything about this movie, I'd say 95% of everything about this movie worked for me, and that includes Chris Cooper as the father, because the you know, we've seen these kinds of movies before, but I don't know that I've ever seen a fist fight at a wedding. I don't know that I've ever seen a heart attack happening because the son confronts his father in a way that is almost mean. We almost lose. I'll speak for myself. I almost lost all sympathy for the Lloyd Vogel character, which is the fictional Tom Juneau character, when he confronts his father, who is trying his best to make up after 15 years before of deserting him and his sister.
And his wife when she was dying.
Exactly, when she was dying. And even though you know that, you come to know all that, there is a moment in which you have to give somebody some credit for trying to make amends. And I don't know. It just feels real. Here's the part I didn't like, is there is a part in which the Lloyd Vogel character is brought into the set, as you mentioned.
That's what he was saying.
And
Nathan
just
didn't like that either.
That's the point in which I went, nah.
He's almost haunted by Mr. Rogers for a minute.
You're going a little bit too far.
It's like a horror movie kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, contrast that with the moment that Hanks pulls off, in which they're sitting across from each other in a restaurant.
I think that's
and
the best
says,
scene in the movie.
Let's be quiet for 1 minute.
Yeah, that was great.
And
he's
quiet, and for a full minute, and at one point, Hanks looks right at us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, that is brave filmmaking,
it takes a good actor to pull it off. It's risky.
He doesn't blink once.
And I think that Marielle Heller has this really kind of easygoing style about the way that she makes movies, even though this one and her debut film, Diary of a Teenage Girl, which I think is still maybe the best thing she's done.
It's so good. I like that too, yes.
That movie also kind of broke off into flights of fancy that were illustrative of the main character's kind of mental state. And this movie does something similar, but it doesn't go nearly as full on as that movie did. And I think that she has this kind of prosaic style where it's not flashy, it's not too much
subdued.
Or overly stylized.
I think that worked perfect for this movie
because
and this character.
Fred Rogers was subdued.
Exactly.
It fits him. So, and there's another moment, I think the scene in the restaurant, because how often is a movie quiet for a full minute?
Well,
exactly.
Plus the fact that I actually started thinking of
exactly
of
because
what
works,
and whom I felt grateful.
It works on you. There's another moment. It's in the trailers where they're on the subway and a bunch of kids start singing the Mr. Rogers theme song.
That could have been super hokey.
That could have been you know, like a deal breaker almost. Right. But the way that Heller shoots that scene, the way that she frames it, it doesn't feel like something that wouldn't happen. And so it almost has this realism to it in a moment that I think in another film with another director would have clanged really badly.
Partly I think that works because all the actors who they use are singing it kind of diffidently, kind of they're singing it, but it's heartfelt, but it's also at the same time, this is a little embarrassing. There was an authentic feel to that moment.
Right.
As you say, which could have been totally off.
And I think that sums up the movie really well, that it's constantly threatening to go too far, to get too sickeningly sweet. And it never really gets there. No. I was impressed by the tonal shifts.
Yeah, it walked
of this.
It navigated this like path that is difficult. And I know there's been some criticism leveled at Tom Hanks, but I really thought he did an amazing job because like you were saying at the beginning, he wasn't channeling, he wasn't, you know, he was immersing himself.
He wasn't impersonating. He wasn't trying
exactly.
to do. Yes,
exactly. And it wasn't that biopic thing. And I really did appreciate that.
No, that's right. And that was A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the murder mystery, Knives Out. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
When you consider the future, please consider Spokane Public Radio in your estate plans. Your gift to the SBR Fund for the Future Endowment will ensure that access to real news, meaningful conversations, and great music will continue forever in our communities. One of the most impactful ways listeners can help is through planned gifts. Details are available from the business office at Spokane Public Radio, your tax accountant, attorney, or the Inovia Community Foundation. More information at SpokanePublicRadio.org/membership. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Let's move now to a movie that Agatha Christie, were she still alive, might approve of. Christie, of course, was the master mystery writer who wrote some 66 novels and 14 short story collections, many of which are still in print. In her hands, as well as in those of many writers who both preceded and followed her, pretty much every kind of mystery plot has been rendered, in print and on screen. Facing this challenge, writer-director Rian Johnson, with his film Knives Out, opts for solving one mystery halfway through, that of the cause of death of the character Harlan Thrombey, a family patriarch played by Christopher Plummer. Then, following another plot path that changes virtually everything we think we've already seen. That would seem to be a daunting task, but Johnson has sure hands, earned doing small art noirs, such as 2005's Brick, and evolving to blockbuster maker with 2017 Star Wars Episode VIII, The Last Jedi. His talent is amplified by the immense skills of an able cast playing various family members and potential murder suspects. That includes Jamie Lee Curtis, Michael Shannon, Toni Collette, Chris Evans, Ana de Armas, Lakeith Stanfield, and maybe best of all, Daniel Craig. The combination makes Knives Out both a bitingly satiric look at family intimacy and a clever and entertaining update of a classic mystery tradition.
I must say, I'm not a huge mystery fan. I do appreciate the genre, and I have to say, my grandmother was a huge Agatha Christie fan, so I read those books as a child.
Yeah, me too.
And so
me too.
I think that it always—
That explains a lot.
I guess it does. But it does, this has some appeal, I think, because people have different memories, different associations with mystery writing, and whether it's from TV or it's from
all the tropes.
Right, exactly. I was skeptical that they were going to be able to pull this off, and I think that they largely did here. But it's interesting because this particular presentation, just for the lawyers who might be among our listeners, it's a really interesting will contest battle. And so you will recognize the Slayer's rule and all types of things come up that I found intriguing from a lawyer perspective.
Okay, now wake up, Nathan. I noticed you nodding
off.
No,
I was going to say that they talk about the will reading in Knives Out, and I think it's Daniel Craig who It's a line I remembered. He calls it a community theater production of a tax return.
True, but yeah. Not necessarily in this particular case.
No, it's much
case,
more exciting than
yes,
that. Yes,
it was. I think that, having this range of like A-list actors was really brilliant in terms of its casting. I have to say Toni Collette didn't really work for me here. I always felt that she was doing an impression, and she has a good American accent, but her character didn't work. But I thought the highlights really were Daniel Craig and Ana de Armas, who, are the two protagonists. The set design is really, spot on, and so that's definitely worth seeing. I think this is a great holiday movie. It's fun and entertaining. Is it going to make my top 10 list? No. But I do think, it's a family movie, I think.
Putting the fun in dysfunctional, I suppose you could say.
Okay, good
it's
point.
A family, it's, point. A, it's a Weinbinder family
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, well, that's accurate. No, it's not. We're nowhere near as rich. I will say that, you mentioned top 10 lists. This is getting really, really significant praise from critics, and I seem to be on the lower end of that.
Yeah, me too. Entertaining is what I would say.
No, clever.
I enjoyed Knives Out. I do like a good whodunit. I like a good mystery. This reminded me a lot of a lot of other movies. Clue is the obvious one. In fact,
right.
They even reference Clue they say, the house looks like a Clue board at one point. So you're thinking of Clue. There's also a lot of sleuth DNA in this movie. The old Laurence Olivier Michael Caine two-hander because of all the statues and stuff around the house.
There's some snarky, comments throughout that are really enjoyable.
Yeah, and of course, a movie like The Last of Sheila, which is one of my favorite kind of obscure 70s movies, written, by the way, by Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins.
Amazing.
Check it out. That's a weird movie. But also Johnson's own film, Brick, his debut film,
right.
Which was kind of this dark teen mystery that had this kind of arch noir dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of channeling that here, but with a goofier sensibility of something like The Brothers Bloom, which was his follow-up movie after that, which is also worth checking out. And so I liked the style of this movie a lot. You've got all the building blocks of the classic Agatha Christie kind of mousetrap style story, the isolated house that's always covered in fog, and you've got the sprawling pool of suspects, and everyone has a motive.
And when people are in the hot seat, there's this whole the backdrop to this
It looks
chair.
Like the Game of Thrones chair,
right.
But it's covered
in
knives.
Right. Yeah.
And you've got the quirky detective in the form of Daniel Craig who comes in sounding like Foghorn Leghorn or
CSI
something.
KFC.
Yeah, and so Benoit Blanc. So you've got all that, and I liked the setup of this quite a lot. I thought that the cast was great. I really like Jamie Lee Curtis. And Don Johnson is just the worst couple in the world. And Michael
and
Shannon.
Chris Evans.
And Michael Shannon just keeps stealing scenes away from everybody else. I liked all that stuff. As a mystery, though, Knives Out, I think, is pretty meager. I think that once everything comes into play and there's that, you got to have it, the long monologue at the end where the detective has figured everything out and he's going to explain it to he gathers everyone in the room and is going to explain it to them. Once you find out what's happened, it's kind of dissatisfying because it's almost too easy. And I don't want to give anything away.
I just kept waiting
for that next twist and it wasn't
all
there.
All the way through, you knew they were going to come back to certain events.
Right.
And you tied them all together in a way. But I agree with you. If it had one more twist or even if there had been more of a collaborative effort.
Yes, exactly. I don't want to spoil Knives Out because it's much more fun if you don't know. Because like you said, you're constantly picking up on little offhand lines and little things that people are doing, thinking, is that going to pay off at the end?
Right.
Yeah. And you know that most of them won't. They're basically all red herrings. They're trying to throw you off the scent. The whodunit part of it is, it's too simplistic to me, even though I didn't guess it. I was trying to guess the movie all the way through, and I was wrong. But I kind of wanted that extra twist. But as a satire, I think this works better than as a mystery.
You may not have guessed it. I didn't guess it. I don't think MP did. But it wasn't a huge surprise either. It wasn't like, oh, wow, that's cool.
I'm just going to say these two words, dogs barking. And I think that's when I figured it out.
I get what you're saying. Like you said, it's not that much of a spoiler. That wasn't really, in the end, the point of it, actually.
We've all commented how well cast this movie was. But I have to take issue with one performance, and it wasn't the actor's fault. I think Lakeith Stanfield was wasted in this film.
Kind of.
I mean, yeah. His character has really nothing to do.
He's just a
except
straight
play
arrow.
The straight guy yeah. to the Daniel Craig
right.
character. And I would have preferred if he had been one of the family members. That would have really...
Well, and that would have underlined the point that Johnson is trying to make at the end, because the final scene of Knives Out, you keep waiting for the solution to the mystery, and that's all well and good, even though we did kind of criticize it pretty harshly. The very last scene of this movie is like a really acidic punchline, and
yes.
you realize
right.
that's what this movie has been about the whole time. The mystery is almost incidental.
Right.
This
See,
works really well.
Too.
It's like
right.
an episode of Succession or something, where it's like it's right. kind of an evisceration of this horrible, rich, white 1% family, and they get what's coming to them
yes.
at the end, and I loved that.
Isn't that kind of a visual representation of OK Boomer?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I don't know how many boomers there are in this movie or how many will be in the audience.
All those actors, basically every one of them, from Don Johnson to Jamie Lee Curtis,
yeah,
they're all
that's true.
Basically
but
at the lower end of
I mean, it is. It,
the
it,
baby boom.
There are a lot of conversations in this movie that I think will be familiar to anyone that's had an awkward conversation at a Thanksgiving dinner table, for instance. and watching the threads of that play out are really satisfying, much more satisfying than the actual murder plot, which, as we've said many times, is pretty level one mm-hmm. kind of stuff. I think Agatha Christie, if she were still alive, would say this needs one more tweak.
I think so, too.
One more extra element to make it a really good solution to this mystery.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say a couple of words about Ana de Armas, because I really did appreciate her performance. And it was so bad. I mean, because here is this woman who, you know, throughout the entire movie, so she plays the maid,
mm-hmm.
so keep that, or the housekeeper, or
the
nurse, the
yeah.
nurse,
mm-hmm.
the caregiver, and nurse and caregiver are not necessarily the same. But they know that she's from a South American
but
country.
They don't know which
and
one.
And no one can ever get it right. And it was like, it just perfectly mirrored.
Paraguay, Brazil.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
I know. It was yeah. like, oh,
that's a
no.
great running joke. Yeah. And again, you think, okay, it's just him kind of illustrating how thoughtless and self-centered these people are. But that running joke pays off in a pretty delicious way at the end.
It sure does.
Just desserts, I would say.
And another point about Ana de Armas is that she's going to be in the next Bond film opposite Daniel Craig. Now, whether she'll be a Bond girl or whether she'll have a more substantial role, I can't say.
Well, I hope Daniel Craig takes along his shaky Southern accent and brings a new twist to the Bond franchise.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
And that was Knives Out. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, my Pat Truthart, and I discussed A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Let's take this time to thank Peter Glarbrook for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you, too, our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember these words from the late, great comedian George Burns. Happiness is having a large, loving, caring, close-knit family in another city. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.